Welcome back to Beholder to No One, a TTRPG podcast. Today I'm here again with Alex. Hello.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about a very important topic that has come up a couple of times in prior episodes, but I don't think I've had a dedicated episode to it, and that is safety tools.
Yes.
If you don't know what safety tools are, a brief rundown. For tabletop players, you should always have a way for the players to provide you knowledge of what they are not okay with, or at least tell them things that you could expect from the game so they can choose if that's something they're not cool with and they need to back away. But I think safety tools are a mandatory. They should be a mandatory unless you're playing with a group that you've been playing with forever and they know what your safety requests are. But if you're playing with new people, always double check. Get safety tools.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I use the most is lines and veils, personally. Is that, what do you use?
So I use a system that is similar. It was actually an adaptation from one that was created by Monty Cook Games back in the day. It's been put out by Gehenna Gaming. They have their own consent form, which is basically the same thing. It goes through a list of topics, which you can mark down if it's something you would be okay with, is something you would be all right with it being in the story, but you don't want to go too into detail, and things that are just flat out not okay. It basically serves the exact same purpose as lines and veils. It's just formulated a little bit differently.
Yeah, where lines and veils, you write out the things that you're not okay with or would like to fade to black, basically. So for me, for example, a line will always be dolls, because I have a phobia of dolls. So I don't want to have them in my games. I don't want to see them. I don't want to be triggered by them. A veil might be sex, because or relationships. Like, I'm fine with role-playing out a relationship, but once you get to that sex part, it's just like, they go to the room, and that's all you have to describe. You don't need to go into detail. Like, that's just awkward for everybody at that table.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny because lines and veils as a system was originally born from the kink community for the exact same purpose, just having a list of items that somebody would be okay with, not okay with, would be okay with trying, that sort of thing, and was adapted into Vampire originally, and then went from there. Not saying the Vampire is the first one to ever have it, but they did use the lines and veils system pretty early on.
It's really interesting, actually, because that makes a lot of sense, because it's huge about knowing what you want and don't want before you do anything in either situation.
Yeah. One of the things that an adage that I've always stood by is that you should, any activity that involves more than one person, you should be having that open field of discussion on what you're going to expect, what you hope to gain out of the encounter, what are things you would be okay with, what are things you would not be okay with. And in gaming, life, relationships, whatever, you're going to find that things are a lot easier to go with. And you're probably going to have a better time because you've laid out those list of things that you are okay with, you're not okay with. Also coming at the individuals that you have participating and saying, this is the thing that I want to do. That gives them the opportunity to say, okay, this is for me, or okay, this is not for me. And that will kind of, when we go into session zero, that kind of can get fleshed out there.
Yes. Also keep in mind that people can add things whenever they want. So if you're on episode 5 of a recording podcast and something happens and the person's like, that did not make me feel comfortable, and they're like, can we add this to the lines? Like, that was really uncomfortable for me. You don't argue, you just add it. And you update everybody in the group.
Yeah, and that's something, I mean, you should be using that in all gaming, and that's really where it comes back to the X card, because you should be using these tools in tandem, because they're going to work better for you. If you run into that situation of an item that you find that you're not okay with, using that X card, and then if you're the one running the game, I would highly suggest touching in with the player, make sure everything's okay. Try to understand what happened, what was bothering them. If they're comfortable with telling you, they obviously don't have to do that. They could have just skipped the scene. They do not owe you any sort of an explanation. But to make it so you avoid that in the future.
Yeah. I've had one instance where my lines were crossed accidentally. And it was funny because it was in a friend's game that knows me very well. And so one of my other extreme lines is maggots. Like, I can't stand them. They just make me really nauseous. We don't mention it. We don't talk about it. We don't bring it up. So they know that this fear exists, or this gross, this disgust exists. And the problem we ran into was, to them, horror is things that scare you. So for them, if it grosses you out or scares you, it's good because they enjoy horror. They enjoy being scared. They enjoy being grossed out from those things. For me, I don't like that. I don't watch horror. I don't want to be scared or grossed out by things unless it's something I'm okay with or approved beforehand. So we had a scene in a game where maggots were described very vividly, and I eventually was like, can they be anything but maggots? And they didn't pick up on my discomfort, and I didn't say anything, but I actually got up and walked out of the room until the scene was done. And I'm like, I told my husband, like, hey, you roleplay my character for me. I'm going to go in the other room for a few minutes. But it was because I was visibly getting nauseous, and I really was getting, like, I felt like I was going to be sick. And after the game, I talked to her about it, and I was like, hey, I don't want that in the scene. And we discussed, and I understood her viewpoints. But she agreed to not put them in anymore, realizing the extreme circumstances.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that you kind of unknowingly sign on for a lot of times when you run a game, is that the people that are at your table are not only there to enjoy the story that you've presented before them, but you also have to take some amount of care over them. I realize that there are people out there who don't do that sort of thing, who run games where there is no X card or whatever, and will actually state that in their game, which, if that's what you want, then that's perfectly fine, and that is available to you. But I would suggest, if somebody is just starting out for the first time, I would approach the game from the standpoint of, I want to make sure that my players are comfortable, know what to expect, what possible things could happen, so that we can tell the best story. Because if you want your players to be immersed, nothing is going to take them out of that immersion faster than something like that. You're going to find a lot more success, I think, if you take the time to speak with your players. And if you're worried about discussing an item spoiling a story point for you, I doesn't necessarily have to do that. You can be really vague with your story points and say to them, like, oh, this could possibly happen, or this could possibly happen, or something else. Just giving them that general scenario makes it so you can still tell your story without any worry of ruining what you've made or hurting your players in any way.
Yeah, there are a few DMs that I've played with enough times that I trust them with the game that I will go into. I will 100% trust them. I know it's going to be a darker game. I know that particular subject matters are going to be coming up that don't make me comfortable, but I'm okay with them being in the story.
Yeah, and that's part of why the Lions of Veils are good, is because, and this is another thing too, when you're talking about checking in on things over the course of the game, one thing I would suggest is, if you have a Lines and Veils that you give to the players before your campaign starts, give it to them again after every 4 or 5 sessions, I would say, or after a major story point happens, just to make sure that everything is still okay, because you don't know what is happening in people's lives. Something could have come up that was okay before is not okay now. At the same time, if you want to look at it the inverse, there could have been something that they weren't okay with before, but now they're kind of okay with and they'd like to explore. So having, you can approach the list as things that you are not allowed to touch, but you should also look at the list of things that you know where the things that you can't touch, but that means that you can go further in the things that are listed as being okay, which is a very common way that Lines and Veils and things like that are used in horror games, where if you say this item is not okay, they'll use the list of things that you said are okay and ramp those up to 11.
Yeah, like at most horror things are fine for me, but there could be like an innocent doll just sitting there and I will start freaking the fuck out. And I'm like, nope, nope, I'm leaving. Or the burning the house down, burn the whole thing down. Don't care. The whole thing's going on fire. That's actually happened. I was watching a stream and it was Curse of Strahd. And there's a scene where one of the houses has a innocent doll that just sits on a rocking chair. And as soon as I heard that, I literally started having a panic attack and I started to mute, or I muted the stream. And I said in the chat, like, can someone please tell me when the scene is done?
Mm-hmm.
And two of the players were antagonizing me in the group chat, saying like, it's the dolls right behind you. And I'm like, no, fucking seriously, like, this isn't cool. Like, please stop. Thankfully, another one of the players was like, cut it out. Like, this isn't okay. And they apologized and it was fine. And then they told me when the scene was done and I turned it back on. But I was like, the last thing, I'm here to support a friend. I don't want to have a panic attack while I'm laying in bed watching Twitch.
Yeah.
Because of something stupid that I can't control.
I mean, but at the same time, it's not something stupid. And this also can be touched back to if you're making a game for content and you are going to have items in it that could possibly scare your players or something that they're bothered by, these tools become all the more important because you could have a game that's not just like this. Curse of Strahd innately probably isn't. It is written as a horror story, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people run it that way. You could have an item in there that people are afraid of, like, that would really unnerve people, or you could have a scenario that suggests something that really would unnerve people. And knowing that information beforehand is vital, especially if you're producing something for content like a stream.
There's actually, for my charity stream last year for the 1 year anniversary of Beholder to No One, we did a Lines and Veils and it was for a Lewd Grannies game. And for those who don't know what Lewd Grannies is, it's made by Joel Salvo. And you play as old ladies who are crashing a wedding. And you roll a d20 and if you have it on your bingo card, you can cross it off and you succeed. If you can't cross it off, you fail. And you have to complete whatever your goal is, one of which was drink your weight in booze before you fail enough times that the nursing home finds out that you're missing and comes and picks you up. Well, this came up and we did the Lines and Veils and the one person was like, actually, we are doing a New Year's Eve theme. And they're like, New Year's Eve with an older drunken alcoholic is a huge trigger for me. And I'm like, that's fucking good to know, because that's something that definitely could have come up in this game. So if anybody rolled the drunk one, we had them re-roll so they got something else.
Yeah.
Because that definitely would have potentially happened, because it was like a 1 in 6 chance of getting it.
Yeah, and I think that it's important that people realize that a safety tool is not just there for if you're going to make things horrible. It can be from something that seems innocent and to some people isn't.
Yep.
Just think that you don't know somebody's life, so it's better to be safe rather than not.
People have some, well, strange isn't the right word, but unique triggers that you would never think of.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's different. Like, a particular phrase could be a trigger for some people, or a particular topic, and you don't know if that's going to come up or not. And it could be a simple topic. And this actually comes up a lot in foster care, too. We did, when I was going through the adoption process, they discussed, or they showed a video of how this girl was given a dress and she freaked out. They had no idea why. And she just threw it at their face and got angry and stormed off and was very upset. And turns out the reason why they got upset is because the last time they were bought a dress, something happened to their mother that was bad. Mm-hmm. And so they associated getting gifts with pain to their parent. And that's what their association to it was. But the foster parent had no idea. They would have no way of knowing that. So it's the simplest things could trigger things. And I'm trying not to go into specific details because it could be a trigger for people.
Yeah.
But It's very interesting when you think about it, and perspective is also key, because that's some things I've learned with my kid is they'll hear one thing and I'll hear it completely differently because of the way we grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Like they'll hear a screaming kid outside in terror and I hear a kid playing.
Yeah.
And they're playing, but they hear screams of terror and they want to go protect. And I'm like, no, it's fine. They're playing, I promise. It's okay.
Yeah.
But one question that might come up with Lines and Veils. Hypothetically, let's say you are running a campaign that is going to be violent. It's a war game. It's political. There is going to be a lot of death, potentially. There's going to be potential capturing of traitors, possible torture scenes. And that's going to be things that come up in the show. What happens if one of the players is like, oh, hey, I don't like violence at all or any of those things, but that's the main part of your entire game?
So this is something that you can kind of cover in a pre-session zero or during a session zero of discussing what your game is going to be about. If a player has an issue specifically within Lines and Veils that is a major driver of your story, you have a couple of options available to you. Number one is that you say, okay, what is another way that I can tell this story? If it's something that has a lot of political intrigue, the fighting can be kind of off screen almost, or done by different people. And then you're more there to drive the politics of the situation if that's something that your people want to do. If it's not, if your game is built to be a very combat heavy game and people are not very comfortable with combat heavy, it may just not be the right game for them, and that is okay. Putting your needs first is important and is okay. You don't need to compromise on your boundaries for somebody else's enjoyment. That, you know, that's not very respectful to yourself and it's not very respectful to them.
Yes. Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I would say that there are times where a player has decided that this game wasn't for them. And that happens a couple of times because there's different play styles, too. I've played in games that are campy and cutesy and fun. And I've played in games that are like horror and terror. And if you sneeze the wrong way, you are at risk of dying, basically. And all of those games aren't meant for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes if someone joined your game and they realize, hey, this doesn't really work for me, it's okay to let them leave the game if that's what they want to do. Especially if you like, if the game is created to be like that and they thought they could handle it, but they realized they couldn't. So I've had that happen before, and it wasn't in like a negative way. They're just like, hey, I'm realizing this isn't really my type of play style.
Yeah.
If you ever do a different game that's more like XYZ, then call me.
Yeah, and that is completely okay. Like I said, putting your needs first is very, very important when it comes to this sort of situation, but also respecting the boundaries of others. If the game is not right for you, there's lots of other games out there. We live in the modern age where there are tons and tons and tons of different games that span a whole variety of topics. You could play a game where you just don't fight anything ever. You could play a game where that's all you do. You mm-hmm. could play a game where you're mainly building cities, or there's a game where you are designing and maintaining a space station. Like there's all sorts of interesting stuff. And honestly, if it's something that you like and something your players like, then it is the best game for you. There's, you know, this is kind of like you, nobody, there is no one best flavor of pie. Certain people have certain tastes and it's the same exact thing. There's always going to be somebody who prefers a different game, and that's awesome. It may not be the game for you, but it is important to recognize that you're having those boundaries yourself is important, and having that ability to say, okay, this isn't something I can handle doing. Or if you're in a scenario where you think you can talk about it with the GM, sit down, talk with them, tell them you're not comfortable, see if they would be open to doing something else. And again, if not, then that's also an okay answer. And then that's when you say, okay, then it's not for me.
Yeah. I know that some games have particular aspects of them that you will expect. So for example, if you're a player that, this isn't necessarily a Line and Veil, but this is also like related to game style. If you're a player that likes to start fights, Vampire might not be the game for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be, but you're going to die really quickly.
Yeah, and I think that with things like that, that also come, and we can kind of start diving into it now, that really comes into that pre-session zero and session zero talk, is sitting down and saying, here's the game, and then giving people an elevator pitch of the game, as well as kind of a brief overview of what they can expect. Because if you are looking to play Vampire the Masquerade in a manner in which you're running around and fighting a bunch of stuff, you could technically do that, but the game is also extremely lethal. So you would run the risk of just dying, which, again, there are people who like that sort of thing. And that's cool if that's what you want to do. You could play a campaign where it's just you playing through a blood hunt. Mm-hmm. It's not the most typical way that people play the game, but that doesn't mean it's wrong.
Right. And also, if you're expecting a roleplay heavy game and then you get a lot of combat, you might be really disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that I think a big reason why I personally never really dove too deeply into D&D was because when I started playing games, I started with a game that was very investigation and narrative heavy. And then when I was introduced to D&D, well, when I was really introduced to it, was at the same time that back in 4th edition, when they used to run the dungeon crawl league things, I don't remember what specifically they were called, but it was something that Wizards put on, and it was similar to Friday Night Magic and what you would do, except it would happen on like a Thursday or something. But what you would do is you would bring your character and you would get thrown into a dungeon and you just fight monsters. And that's what you do.
And some nights that sounds like a fucking blast, but
yeah. And there were always a ton of people at that game that really enjoyed themselves. And that's awesome, but that's not what I want to do.
Yeah. I like mixing it up. Like, I have made D&D games super roleplay heavy. It takes a lot of effort though. Like, yeah. My Sunday game is more roleplay focused than anything. And everything that they do in the game is like, it's open world basically, or sandbox, and they're just stuck in Waterdeep basically, and they tell me what they want to do, and that's what happens. I can throw in little things here and there. Oh, you tripped over something. Oh, here's an NPC who's cute. Or oh, you ran into some bandits because you're looking for this necklace. So far they've gotten in like two fights maybe, and we're on session 4.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quick fights, and I think they both ended the same way, and that was with a sleep spell. Because the one person's like, I use sleep on the pixies to knock them out so we can capture them and they can stop attacking us. And then they have enough time to get the item they need and run before they wake up. And that's also how they defeated the next, like, the actual big bad in the scene. They cast sleep in an area where only they and an unconscious person and a half elf were. So it only affected the mm-hmm. bad guy. And I reward that type of stuff because that's a clever way to avoid having to kill people if you can avoid it and you don't want that blood on your hands. And I was introduced more to role playing out things and getting out of fights from a character in my Monday game. And I love the creativity that comes with it because they come up with such intriguing ways to convince someone who's supposed to be like evil to give up the person that they captured or to help them. And then I have to think on my feet and be like, okay, well, I don't want them to be servants. That's not the way like this is going to work. So what can I do? What could these people want from the person that it makes it interesting and worth it to them to free the people they captured?
Yeah. And I think that that's something that's being dove into a lot more recently, is finding, having things that are more fleshed out and more intuitive and stuff like that. And I think that a lot of production RPGs also are a good, like, shows that are produced and RPGs produced for content are a very good driver of that sort of thing, because we have seen a lot more games that have these alternate means to solving a puzzle, as well as making combat that is more interesting by adding in different things for the players to use. Because at the end of the day, and this is true for if your game is produced for content or it's not, as long as your players are having fun, having a chance to feel cool, being able to run around and do stuff and whatever else, they're going to enjoy themselves. And if you have an audience and they can tell that your players are enjoying themselves, they will also enjoy themselves, because that's usually how that goes. If you have happiness in your game, other people feed off of that.
Yes, I have learned that. It brings them back to your paid games.
Mm-hmm.
You get more money.
Mm-hmm.
The other big thing to talk about in Session Zeros, other than just lines and veils, is expectations and rules that you are going to use that aren't necessarily in the game that you're playing. So for D&D, for example, I always have a particular set of game rules that I personally prefer, and those aren't the norm in 5th edition. So things like 1s and 20s will always be crits, or crit fails or crit successes. It doesn't matter what it's on. But if you roll a natural 1, there is a chance that I'll tell you to roll again if you have an ally in the area and see what happens. It might hit the person, another person. You're not sure.
Yeah, and I think that's specifically from the rules standpoint. The thing that people will always say in any game design is that the rule that works best for your table is the best rule. Even if you're producing something for content, if you put in a rule that is more fun for everybody, it doesn't really matter if it's right, as long as it flows well with the story and makes things more interesting.
Yeah, another one I like is succeed at a cost, which yes. I recently learned was in 5th edition. I thought of it through Monster of the Week, and then when I said something about it, someone was like, that's in 5th edition already. It's under optional rules in the DM's guide. And I'm like, the fuck? I should read that probably.
Yep, that is also in Vampire. So it's very, yeah. It is more fun, I think, to do success at a cost, because it offers you the ability to, you don't want to sit there just repeatedly throwing dice at the same thing over and over and over again. That can get really boring. Mm-hmm. And you also don't want to lock people out of an area that they need to go to. So you want to have that element of fear or anxiety, like saying, you need to get through this door. You roll to see if you can pick the lock. If you fail picking the lock, you don't just fail. You tell the player, okay, you fail, and you can ask them if you've established this. Say, would somebody else like to try, or would you like to succeed at a cost? And if they say succeed at a cost, you say, okay, the door pops open, but it also, the locking mechanism also falls out on the other side, and now it's made a bunch of noise and stuff like that, and then now you have to respond to this new problem, and, you know.
Yeah, I use this in a stream for the first time because I wanted to try it, and I just really liked the actual effort and ability, and they rolled a nat 1, and technically that's a crit fail. They would have lost the trail. The story would have ended. They shouldn't have been able to find the people, and that's boring. That's, especially for content, like, that's a boring way to end the story. So I'm like, do you want to fail, where you will lose the trail and you will fail this mission? Do you want to succeed at a cost? What's my cost? You don't know yet. So they say succeed at a cost. I said, okay, you either are losing your wagon, or it'll take you 4 hours to find the trail again. Which do you choose? And this was a tough one because they wanted to have the wagon, but they knew if they waited the full 4 hours that they had risk of losing the people and their lives would be revoked from them. And they didn't want that risk, so they lost the wagon. The second time they rolled a nat 1, the very next time, I said, okay, well, do you want to succeed at a cost? And they said, yes. I said, do you want a trap or do you want a fight? Didn't specify what trap, it didn't specify what fight. It ended up being a trap with a fight because they put somebody else there. And I'm just like, sure, why not? We'll go with it. But I just rolled a random trap, and the trap was, they had a gazebo there. And if you walked onto the gazebo, you lost 1d4 hours of memory. So they walked onto the gazebo, the first player lost 4 hours of memory, and then eventually stepped off of the gazebo, and then forgot about the thing because he forgot his memories, and then saw the person they just killed, and was like, is that Bear Grylls? And then runs back onto the gazebo and lost another 2 hours of memory. And I'm like, so 6 hours ago was the beautiful singing you heard of the Bullywugs. You forgot that. And they're like, oh, thank God. That was nightmare inducing. And I'm like, sure. And it's just minor things like that cause a little bit of irritation because, like, they would have forgotten where their wagon was. They would have forgotten that this person that they left with the wagon, they would have potentially forgotten their job requirements, which could have all been very bad.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, not all of them lost their memories, so they were able to, like, go back into the scene and continue with the journey.
That's cool.
Hello. Sorry for the interruption here, but I wanted to give you an advertisement for one of our friends in the tabletop community. Please give it a listen and go check them out.
Hey, Amber.
Hey, Kenny.
I got a question for you.
Okie dokie.
If you were a burn spell, how much damage would you do?
Infinity!
So greedy.
Infinity, infinity, infinity! Kill all creatures!
Speaking of infinity, if you want infinite good content, you should check out our Magic the Gathering podcast, Red Mage, Blue Mage, on the Geek Spective Network.
Right, you'll hear great content, such as me reading you fanfiction, and also us asking each other more stupid questions, and talking about constructing and designing cards!
Yeah, and doing cube drafts and commander games against each other. You can hear this content, this infinite content, on Spotify, iTunes, and other major platforms.
You can find us on Twitter at RedBlueMTG.
So why don't you come along over? Yeah, fuck.
Don't say that!
And now, back to the show.
I also like pushing to do a little bit more damage, so would you like to risk something to kill this person?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have 2 health left. It would make so much more sense. Like, you could technically, as a DM, just flub it and say, like, yeah, you killed it. They have 2 less health. Because it makes story sense and it's epic. You could also say, do you want to try to push that attack? And them pushing will do the more harm to kill the person off. But in exchange, there's like a minor injury. Like, they were covered in a rope, they chuck a dagger, and their wrist gets stuck in the rope, and they twist it. So they're rolling with disadvantage with their offhand or whatever for the next day or the next 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But they killed the person and ended the fight. So is it worth it?
Yeah.
What are some session zero stuff that you like to have?
So I usually do the same things throughout all my session zero games, which is before the session zero, I will give everybody a document that contains all the information on the game, what they can expect, and the forms for them to fill out. So like the consent forms and stuff like that, as well as understanding the safety tools that will be present. I like to get all that out in the open first, just to have a brief overview for everybody. And then during session zero, we sit down and we talk. The biggest question I ask people is, what do you want to get out of this game? And then using that answer will help me to craft my story, as well as to understand and make sure that everything is, we're all going to work well together. Then after the session zero, where we've gone through all the information, that's when I usually ask them to fill out the forms if they haven't already, or make any modifications to them. Because there'll be things that I pre-fill out on all the forms, of things I just flat out will not do, just so everybody's on the same page. But I think session zero is extremely important because it not only allows you to make sure that those safety tools are present, it also allows you to kind of map out the story and the flow and what the players can expect to better help them make that judgment of if it is right for them. Because if they're looking for a game where they just run around and kill people and you're playing a game that is more narratively driven, then they're not really going to feel at home because they haven't, that's not the type of character that they wanted to make.
Yes. I think other things that I might add to session zeros is reminders of things that will get you kicked out of the game.
Yes.
Which it takes a lot to do, but my 2 biggest ones are metagaming and power gaming. Power gaming, when you're doing it naturally and you're not purposely doing it, is one thing. Like, you get good luck and you succeed, that's fine. If you build a character that's purposefully broken as fuck just to mess with shit so that you are more powerful than everybody else at that table, I will just say no to your character. And if you just keep doing it, I'm just going to say, if you don't make a normal character or a character that isn't broken as fuck, then you're not welcome at my table, because I hate having characters that are so much more powerful than the rest of the party, to the point of it's not fair. And then metagaming wise, I will remind people a lot of times, like, hey, you don't actually know that. If they fight me about it, then I will kick them out of my game. I will give them warnings, and this is if it's excessive, obviously. It's not going to be the first time you're gone by, piss off, whatever. But if you constantly try to meta things and constantly cheat and constantly add in things that you're not supposed to know, then it gets really old really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Private conversations are one of the ones that I prefer. That's hard sometimes. Like for me, that's the one that's difficult for me. I will accidentally remember a conversation having happened, but I don't remember if it was to me or somebody else at the table. Mm-hmm. And I might say, well, didn't we have that conversation with blah, blah, blah about this? And they're like, you weren't there. I'm like, oh shit, right, okay, sorry. And that was technically me metaing, but I didn't intend to. I wasn't purposefully like trying to cheat. I was just, I remembered the conversation and I was trying to remember. But if you're like, no, it was that actually that conversation, I think we discovered blah blah blah, it's like, no, shh, shh, shh. You weren't there, stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
The one that pisses me off the most is if they go against a role and the role succeeds and they still are like, well, I don't trust you, like your insight failed their deception, you have no reason not to trust them. Well, they're untrustworthy. I'm like, why? Because they stole something. You don't know that. You didn't see them steal anything. And they lied to you successfully that they didn't steal anything. You have no reason to be suspicious.
Yeah. Yeah, that really comes down to separating player knowledge and character knowledge, which is, that is definitely something I go through too in session zero, just kind of giving everybody a quick overview of the kinds of things that we can expect and the way that we are going to play it. And I think, really, instead of, it's more for me, it's more of like, this is how the game is going to go, because if you push against it, we're probably not going to have a good time. The only time I've ever actually kicked anybody off of the table is if they're disrespectful or not respecting people's boundaries or homophobic, transphobic, racist, anything else like that, then they're gone. But I think for everything else, I usually just try and give them a quick overview at the beginning of like, this is what you can expect. So like, metagaming is not a thing that you'll do, because it's like, it doesn't benefit you most of the time.
Yeah. I think I've only kicked out 3 people, maybe. I mostly leave games.
Yeah.
I think 2 people. One was a game I was running, and one I finished the game but told them, like, I'm never DMing for you again. Like, I refuse to have you in my future games. But I finished the session because they were short, one-shot type things. The last one, the person left, but I had been complaining to the DM about them because of their way of playing. They were the power person that needed to be in control of everything, and everybody needed to do it the way that they wanted you to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the 3. I mean, technically the last one doesn't count because I didn't kick them out, but I was definitely the person that pushed it to happen. And then they eventually left on their own. But when I was told they were coming back to the game, I'm like, I'm retiring then. Yeah. I don't want to play with them. I eventually left that game anyway, so it doesn't matter. But like, I loved the game. I loved the story. I loved the characters. I just didn't like that one player.
Yeah.
And if I never play with that player again, I would be happy.
Yeah. And I think that really comes back to like, you need to put yourself first, because ultimately this is a game. We are here to have fun. If you're not having fun, you need to analyze why you were there.
Honestly, I just really like the character.
Yeah. I mean, like, I would argue that there's other opportunities to play the character.
I know, we've had that conversation where we just have like we're going to have a game where we bring back all of our characters who never got to see their final ending.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is like that, I'm sure that happens to a lot of people. I'm sure there are all sorts of people that have these really ambitious ideas for their characters that never come to fruition.
I have so many characters that I want to play again. Like Rissa for Lanner, for example, from Clearlight, they barely got to a high enough level to like justify leaving. What level did she get to? I mean, it was end of their story, but she could continue somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
She got to level 12 and Tari got to level 13. I want to know what happened beyond that. Where do they go? What do they do? What happens? Does Tari fix her anger issues? Does she get married to Skylar, their androgynous partner? Or do they save the day? Do they, were they able to defeat the big bad bitch? Because the big bad guy was bitch. I want to know those things. I want clarification. And then I have characters like Roya, who I fucking loved, and she was level 6, and we never continued on to, we finished Dragon Heist, but we never went on to the next one. Tower of the Bad Mage. Tower of the Bad Mage? I don't know. I will find it, so I am correct. Or I will not find it.
It's all good.
Oh, okay. So it technically isn't meant to be directly after, it just fits, because at the end of Dragon Heist, they want to go to the Undermountain, and in the Dungeon of the Mad Mage, you go to the Undermountain. So it's not technically like a secondary book, I thought it was. It's just another random game that could be used afterwards, but you could technically use any of the other ones too, depending how you wanted to go.
I think that they owe that with a lot of stuff to go after Lost Minds of Phandelver, just because it is such a quintessential intro for so many people.
Yeah, that's what like gets people into the game.
Yeah.
I honestly haven't actually run a campaign book, pre-built module, in a very long time.
Mm.
I just do homebrew now, because I can make it up as I go. I don't need to read anything.
I do enjoy using modules in games just to get an idea sometimes. Oftentimes, if I've never ran a game before, I will usually look for the intro module. I will either use it or make a modification to it and make it my own. But I really like to see the way that people intend for the games to flow. Mm-hmm. And then after that, my ideas can really start spewing forth. That's just usually the way that I've always approached it.
Yeah, I think like I enjoyed playing in Dragon Heist, and I fell in love with Waterdeep as a city because of how robust Dragon Heist makes it. It makes the characters and makes the NPCs. So there is so much detail given in that world, you could literally do anything. And my favorite part of playing Dragon Heist was getting to know the NPCs and running the tavern and meeting people and rescuing kids and building a prostitute house and a weed empire, all the things.
Yeah.
As one does. But those were my favorite parts. Like the actual storyline was secondary to what I was actually enjoying from the game. My favorite part was dating a bad guy. That was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go on the circus boat.
That is pretty awesome.
I thought so. Everybody said he's a bad guy, but I'm like, no. What are you talking about? He's not bad. He just kills some people. It's fine. We kill people. Who are we to judge? But yeah, that actually is another thing. If you are going to play with homebrew, mention that in your session zero. Mention what is allowed, what isn't allowed. If you have any particular character types that you hate, bring it up at the beginning of the game. For example, any Warforged in my game have to be shut down for at least 4 hours a night, even though technically that's not how the rule works. But technically, I don't give a fuck. I don't like the fact that they don't sleep. So,
yeah. And I mean, that really just comes down to laying out those expectations early on and telling people the type of game that they're going to be in, really. With stuff like D&D, there's a lot of homebrewed elements to it when it comes to the player characters. So for that, it's a lot more in depth than, say, some other games where there may not be as much. But it is something you should always do, is just sit down and say, you know, here's the things that I'm going to be okay with. If you want to leave it open to discussion, you are welcome to do that as well. If you don't want to leave it open to discussion, you are also afforded that opinion. You know, it's your game. You can run it however you want. And like I said, if your players don't want to play in it, then they are completely within their rights to say no.
Yep. The other big thing to learn is, as a DM at least, you are not against the players.
Yeah. No, you never are.
You are there to run with the story and tell a good story, and you want to have your players succeed. You might want it to be challenging, even though sometimes it feels like, haha, I got you. But you're not technically out to go and just murderize everybody, technically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that this is something that I picked up really from playing a lot of narrative heavy games, which is that I see the GM/DM as being another person, like another player at the table. Everybody is there to enjoy themselves, including the GM or DM. Everybody is there to have fun and tell a good story, including the GM or DM. if people want to play a game where it's them versus the person running it, that's cool if that's how they want to play in that. Personally, I don't. But that's also because I prefer those things that are more narrative heavy, more story driven, and why I tend to gravitate towards games that are designed to be that way. Like in Vampyre, a lot of your building of the game is determined by what your players are and what your players do. So sitting down with them and figuring all that early on is very, very important so that you can make the story that is fun and engaging for everybody. That doesn't mean you don't get to throw something heinous at them, because you can definitely do that. I would also say explore throwing things at them that they can't win.
Yes.
The reason for that is, because the reason for that is to give them an opportunity to look for something else that they can do or some other way out of this situation. In Vampyre, the best example I can give is throwing a werewolf at people, which in that universe, werewolves are essentially, they're 10 feet tall. They can pick up and throw cars with ease. Like, they are when they're in full combat form, they are just there to kill. And they're not made to kill vampires. They're made to kill things that are much nastier and much bigger. So if a vampire runs into one and it's in full combat form, the chances that the vampire makes it through that are pretty slim. But they have other things that they can use to their advantage to try and run away from them, get away from them, incapacitate them, something like that. And that can really add a lot to the game. Just the same as having enemies that are very interesting and can help with building dread. It's always a good time because it makes players more fearful of the character, but also adds that element of fun of waiting for it to appear.
I like adding monsters that also know when to run away so they can recuperate and reanalyze the situation.
Yeah, I would suggest, just to make you better at running a game in general, I would suggest taking a look at the book, The Monsters Know What They're Doing. It is a book written specifically from the D&D perspective, but it is all about designing more interesting combats and making these characters that fight against the players, but also make decisions that would make sense for them. A monster sitting there fighting until it dies is probably not going to happen. If it came out looking for food, it's probably going to try to attack them. Once it determines that it's not going to get that, it's going to try and run away.
Yeah.
Just the same thing with people. Most people you run into, a mercenary group, probably aren't going to fight you until death, because that's not part of their prerogative. So they might have other things that they try and do. Maybe barter with you, maybe run away, whatever else. That book is The Monsters Know What They're Doing by Keith Amon, which you can find on most platforms at this point.
I mean, I know we talked about enemies as well 2 weeks ago. So if you want to learn more about enemies, you should listen to that episode if you have not already.
Indeed.
The other thing that I think, the thing I like to add in Session Zeros a lot, is having the players have some say in the world to a point. So like, where are you from? Tell me the details about your city. Tell me what you loved about it, what you hated about it. Who is in charge? Who are your family members? Who are people that you may run into? Who are people you don't want to run into? Stuff like that. And then also, what are some rumors that you've heard recently? Give me two rumors. And then I can use those as fodder for the game if I ever need to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sitting down and going through the characters really adds a lot to not only your game, but your players' enjoyment. If you have a character who has put a lot into their backstory, or even if they haven't put a lot into it, but has put some cool points, there's a reason why they wrote them down. So including some of their points in your game might, like, would really engage them and would really be kind of cool. Or, you know, if you think that your player would go for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Not just kidnapping the person that's close to them or killing the person that's close to them or anything else like that. If your player gives you a lot of information, use that information, because it's going to help you to write your story. It's going to help you to make a more interesting session. It's also going to help you to make a session that they kind of already dictated for you on the way that it's going to go and the things that you can introduce. So it's really a really, really good tool to have at your disposal.
I think a good way to hint that, oh, hey, we know about X, like, hypothetically, you have a daughter or a niece that you love with all your heart, and nobody, you keep it very secret, and nobody should know about them. And then the big bad is just like, so how's Susan? And that's the kid's name.
Mm-hmm.
or I heard that Susan's 6 now. That's
yeah.
a big age. And like, just make a small comment that to nobody else seems threatening, but they just were like, I know about the person you love the most. And they didn't threaten, but is there the under how the person takes it is up to the player. But if they purposely were keeping that secret and they were keeping them safe, then that is something that is bad. And that's actually been used against me in character, where the big bad had the names of my character's entire family and their partner written down as leverage opportunities against my character. They had a little black book of blackmail material, basically. Mm-hmm. And my character's family was in witness protection, but they were in like a witness protection program through this bad guy that they didn't know was a bad guy. So she didn't know where they were, and she had to find out. Thankfully, she did find out. But then like her partner worked for this person too, so that they saw everything that happened and never even came to a thought like, oh, hey, that's bad that they know that.
Mm-hmm.
It was small little things like that that just add to the story. So she was very mad when she found that book.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I will punch this bitch in the fucking face. Where is she? We don't know. Find her so I can punch her. And I punched the wall and my hand hurt. They're like, what did you learn? Nothing. And I like having little works for the characters too. This is kind of off topic, but it kind of isn't. Like Renee, for example, she is nerdy as fuck, and I love it because I get to bring out all my nerddoms, and she's trying to hold on to all of the things. And I like that she calls her driver Captain Kirk because it pisses him off but also amuses her.
Okay.
Which nobody understands that reference because you haven't heard any of the show, but that's fine. Spoilers for Dice Before Dawn, Phoenix by Night.
Yes, I am very excited for people to hear more about it.
Yes. Once we have more episodes recorded and can edit them, that is a option. Any last minute suggestions for session zeros, for safety tools?
I think if there was one thing that people would take away, the biggest takeaway is always going to be communicative, be respectful, and, you know, make sure that you are sitting down and mapping things out with people. Because if you have that those proper lanes of communication open, you are going to have a much better time in literally every aspect of life.
Yeah. And be willing to adjust if necessary.
Yes.
Don't give them shit for it.
Yes.
Also, as the DM, be ready to maybe having to have a serious conversation with another adult, and even if you don't like confrontation, because you might need to do that if a problem player exists. That's my least favorite part.
But that's one of those things, and the reason why session zero is so helpful is because you kind of can get that beforehand, which is something, a big reason why I always do it.
Yeah, you can get a lot of it, but sometimes things come up later where it's just like, can you not?
Mm.
And then they don't see it as a problem. So you have to do that. But yeah, so Alex, where can everybody find you?
So you can find me on pretty much most social media outlets, as well as on Twitch under the username @AlexADM89. You'll be able to find me on Dice Before Dawn, as well as on a bunch of other interviews and productions, both in the past and the future. Best place to find all that is going to be on my Twitter, which is just @AlexDM89. And from there, I can give you, or you'll be able to find pretty much all of my goings on, because that's where I post it.
Yeah. There's also lots of episodes on here with Alex in them.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dragon Heist. Nope. That's the wrong name. Sorry. Honey Heist is the word I meant to say.
Yes, I did enjoy playing as Bartholomew.
And Spyhinder?
Yep.
And then a bunch of discussion episodes. But yes, you should go listen to all of them because they are fun and we had fun. Definitely go follow Alex and give them some love. Go follow them on Twitch. Watch them play. What game are you playing again?
Right now, I am streaming on Mondays and Wednesdays. I am streaming King's Quest 6 at the moment. After this, I think we are going to do some Vampire Requiem. After that, we will be moving on to King's Quest 7. Basically, the best way that I can sum up my channel is I just play a bunch of old adventure games and crappy graphics horror games because my computer can run them and they're super fun for me to share with everybody.
Yeah. So go check those out. You can find me at Beholder to No One, at Sound Control RPG, or at Dice Before Dawn on Twitter, mostly on Beholder to No One. Please note that we are trying to hit a goal of 10,000 downloads by December 30th, which will be our 2-year anniversary here. So please go share with your friends, have a listen to a couple of episodes, and help us get that goal, because we are 400 downloads away as of the 6th. I do not know what it will be at on the day this episode is live. Hopefully we have already hit the goal, but if not, or even if we did, go listen to more shit. You can also find me on Awfully Queer Heroes for the Fall of Waterdeep campaign as a player, and the Finished Uncaged anthology as a DM. And in the future, you will find me on Awfully Queer Heroes for the Towers of Soul game that I will be DMing, where it is super deadly and we get to play as the Chaos crew, basically just chaotic monsters trying to fight back against the good that has been trying to eradicate them. And I was allowed to bring out my evil side, so I'm having a lot of fun with that. You can also find me on Friday nights at 2000 Tales on Twitch, or you can find that also on podcast form, which is two very different shows. So if you want to listen to both, feel more than welcomed, because the stream is more funny haha moments, but the actual show itself has music added and voice alterations and all that stuff, and it's really cool. So I think that's everything I got, though. Probably not, but that's fine. If you need anything, please don't hesitate to reach out, and keep being awesome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, before you go, I just wanted to let you know that this episode was edited by Matt over at Walsh Animation. They are part of the Table Party podcast, and I wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to them, especially because Matt has been such a freaking lifesaver when it comes to editing the discussion episodes recently. So please listen to this ad for Table Party podcast and go check them out and make sure you give them some love. Thanks.
What makes Table Party different from other tabletop podcasts?
The music.
The setting.
The characters.
The gore.
A bunch of different games.
The refreshing coldness of ice cream.
The 300-foot-tall squid named Delilah.
The dice rolls.
The horrifying body horror.
The aroma.
The suffering of my players.
Dairy Queen blizzards.
The luxurious plush texture.
The free coupons.
Bad decisions.
And who can we expect?
I'm Kelsey.
I'm Matt.
I'm Gabe.
I'm Walsh.
I'm Chris.
Welcome to the Table Party.
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 Welcome to the Table Party.